Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Can you see the picture? Is it in focus?
Yes.
Yeah? It is? Okay. If things suddenly go out of focus, or you know, I start talking too fast, or you don't understand something, please raise your hands. I should say that this picture, in addition for being something for you to look at while I'm trying to figure out if this electronic stuff is working, is actually in a way how I got started on this. Many years ago, my mother demanded that I come back to my parents' house and clean out the attic full of stuff that I left there when I went to freshman year in college. And I found my ninth grade American history textbook. And this was the frontispiece on there, and it was labeled The Americas Before Columbus. And I stared at it in kind of amazement. I love this picture because it's relatively rare that you see a picture in which absolutely everything is wrong. Usually, you know, you get one or two things kind of right by accident, but this was like I was pretty close to 100% wrong as this paradigmatic image of Americas before Columbus. I mean, most of you probably know horses didn't exist here before, you know, Columbus. Now, there were people who wore these hats, but none of them were in, I think that must be the Rocky Mountains. And I don't have any idea what this is. This is some guy who's sort of a refugee from a Wagnerian opera or something. And then here, I think that's tumbleweed. And tumbleweed is actually an exotic species, an invasive species. It came from Russia in the 1820s and 30s, and it sort of exploded over the West and was widely regarded by both the natives and the newcomers as this confounded nuisance. And in fact, when Nebraska became part of the United States, one of the first things its legislature did was try to debate whether to build a fence around Nebraska to keep the tumbleweed out. And they actually started building it, and then they realized the cause was hopeless. But anyway, this is pretty much what I learned when I was in my ninth grade American history course in Highland Junior High School about the first 15, 20,000 years of American history. And what we learned with these three things, that Native people walked across the Bering Straits about 12,000 years ago, not all that long ago as these things go. They lived for the most part in these small, scattered bands, and they had so little impact on the environment that when Columbus landed, you know, the whole hemisphere was basically a wilderness. And one way to summarize the last 30, 40 years of research by archaeologists, anthropologists, geographers, botanists, ecologists, you know, people from many, many different fields, is to say that all three of these things are now thought by the overwhelming majority of researchers to be wrong. Indians were far longer than previously believed, and nobody really has any idea how long the typical numbers they get thrown around are 20 to 35,000 years. They're here in much greater numbers than previously believed. Again, nobody really knows, but typical numbers are 40 to 60 million. These numbers keep rising, and as a sort of a personal guess for what it's worth, I wouldn't be surprised if it shook out around 80 to 100 million, but that's just a guess. And they have far greater environmental impact than previously believed. And that's something I'm going to be talking quite a bit about tonight. So in light of this, I thought maybe I would suggest something that should be in your children's ninth grade American history textbook as a paradigmatic image of the Americas before Columbus. And this is Tenochtitlan. This is the capital of what's called the Aztec Empire. It's this huge mural. It's on the wall of this fantastic archaeology museum in Mexico City, done by this terrific Mexican artist, Miguel Covarrubias. What this is there's a big basin in the center of Mexico ringed by these mountains. It was very low and swampy, and over a period of centuries, Indians drained it out and created this large artificial lake. Last I heard, I think it's about the size of Delaware or something. It's just really a big lake, sort of S-shaped. On the western side were these low, swampy islands, and then very much like Venice, they drained the islands and then scoured the bottom of the lake and built up more islands around it and separated them by canals and created this kind of artificial city, a very Venice-like artificial city. The big difference between this and Venice is that this is much, much larger. Venice's population never really got above 100,000, and the latest estimates I've seen for this are between 200 and 225,000. Thing to note also that they had, that Venice didn't see this here, these are these baffles. And what they're used is to, there's a spring surge of water that comes in, and it's very much like the Aqua Alta in Venice, that the tide that comes in and inundates the city. And the native people had the technology to stop the city from washing away. They're basically installing this right now in Venice today. There's this big UN program. project to build what is essentially this thing around Venice. A couple other things Covarrubias didn't know about. There are these big aqueducts that brought water in, fresh water. It had running water, which and you know, clean streets and so forth. There's a group of 1,000 you know, street cleaners to keep the place going. And then the whole place had thousands and thousands of boats bringing you know, people and goods and services around. It was this tremendously busy, active place. And then all around here were suburbs. It was one of the most heavily urbanized places in the world. And the reason for talking about this is that most of the people in the Americas at the time of Columbus either lived in cities or were connected to them because they lived in villages that provided food for those cities. It was very much like Europe in that way, that you know, it was dominated by these large cities, and then you know, a lot of the population lived in the hinterland, but they were kind of under the thumb of the cities. And this wasn't by any means any kind of exception. And the largest city north of the Rio Grande is Cahokia. Some of the largest earthen monuments anywhere in the world is still there. This is obviously an artist's reconstruction. It sprang up rather suddenly in about 1000 AD and has these enormous things. To give you some idea of how much we in the United States take care of our native heritage, this was recently upgraded from a county to a state park. There's a big interstate highway, I think it's an interstate highway, that cuts right through the middle of it and wiped out a bunch of the mounds. You know, probably the largest of these is Teotihuacan, an hour north by rattling bus of from Mexico City. Any of you who are interested in urban planning can't be helped but be impressed by this 11-mile-long horizontal axis that orients the whole city, kind of like the Champs-Élysées or something like that. We've got these enormous pyramidal structures and then lots and lots of rich people's houses and temples lining it. But the important thing is that this whole place, all the way up here to the foothills of the mountains, was city. And you can go there now and you can walk for hours and you're walking over people's houses. Estimates of its population go up to 500,000 in, you know, on the order of 200 AD. And there's actually, I actually have a, you know, sort of a learned article in which there's a big debate about whether it was the world's largest city or the second largest city or, you know, the third largest city or what have you. Again, it was an enormous, large place. Now, one of the things that I wanted to try to illustrate to get the idea that this is a busy, thriving place is I had noticed that historians, when they draw maps of Europe in 1500, draw nice, neat boundaries around the country as if they were real boundaries like we have now, whereas the archaeologists are very careful and scholarly, and they'll just show these you know, terrain maps with these vague place names on there. So I decided, being a journalist, I could be irresponsible, and I would draw an irresponsible historian-style map of the Americas at the time of Columbus. This is what Columbus hit, if you like. And start in the middle here. That's the Triple Alliance, which is probably a better name for what we call an Aztecs, of this very rapidly expanding imperialist people conquering all the natives around them. Then right next to them was another group of people called the Taraskans, also equally aggressive, you know, expanding. They had this kind of heavily armed frontier with standing armies. You know, they're like between North and South Korea today, people yelling and shouting at each other and so forth. Then up here in North America, got all these things, the Kuta, the Casa, the Calusa, who are these sort of state-like polities are sort of coalescing into larger societies, kind of like you know Italy or something like that at the time. Then you have these loose groups of villages, the Algonquian Alliance. The biggest one of these is the Haudenosaunee, who is the Iroquois, the Wendat, the Huron. Now, but the action is really down here. If you're interested in you know, sort of power politics, this is Tawantinsuyu, the Inca Empire. The largest sort of centrally governed polity anywhere in the world at the time, stretching over a distance equivalent from Stockholm to Cairo, world's largest highway network. This you know very very you know impressive state control. Again, also very rapidly expanding by a bunch of military geniuses who are sort of moving population around. It's really thoroughly impressive and sort of thing to read about and be glad that you don't actually live there. And then all through here, you'd see all these names here. This is all relatively recently sort of rediscovered. There's a whole bunch of polities here. They don't really conform to any kind of Western models. We don't really know what to call them. They're not really chiefdoms or kingdoms or what have you. We don't really know their borders, but because I'm being a historian, I just drew lines around them anyway and said there they are. There was something there. These lines are completely bogus, but there's a lot of stuff going on in the Amazon. Now, the point is that, you know, that it often presented when Columbus comes here, he sort of collides into this big empty space. And it wasn't. It was full of people. It had their own history, something that we know quite a bit about. The question then least I get invariably asked is, well, it was so full of all these people, what happened? How is it that small groups of Europeans were able to come in and roll over the place? And to learn something from the answer, you have to go back a couple hundred million years ago when there was a single continent, Pangaea. And you guys, you know, know about plate tectonics and how the continents separate. You know this? Yeah. And so this is all illustration. And the point is, somewhere around here, you know, the hemispheres diverge, and you end up with completely different suites of plants and animals in Europe and Asia and the Americas. And by a freak of history, which you, if you're curious, I can tell you more about, what happens is that Europe and Asia end up with almost all the domesticable plants, with almost all the domesticable animals, excuse me. You know, cows, horses, sheep, goats, chickens, all those are in Europe and Asia and not in the Americas. And you can see the difference that this makes in people's lives. Here's this you know, sort of typical Dutch interior scene from the 17th century. And the point about this is that the people are living with their animals. You know, if you're a lower middle class or poor person, you're essentially living in your barn. And then in the next room over is the animals. Now, for an epidemiologist, this is highly interesting because what it means is that you're sort of living in this big soup of animal bacteria and viruses. And every now and then, one of these animal bacteria and viruses mutate, and they turn into a human, one that can infect human diseases. And so over time, as all these Europeans and Asians were living with their animals, they picked up this enormous disease burden. And so this is what this looks like from if you're an epidemiologist. Over here, you have the measles and TB coming from cow disease, influenza pertussis from these chickens, smallpox from these horses, although it could be camels, rabies from the bats in the ceiling. And so you have this, you know, tremendous disease burden. Now let's look at the equivalent house in the Americas at the same time. Basically, this is a replica of Powhatan Longhouse from Virginia. It's architecturally, it's extremely similar. You know, that there's a glass in the windows, in the European one maybe, but there's not glass in here. But as a piece of architecture, it's pretty much the same thing. Construction methods are very similar. And the major difference is that all the animals are dead. Right, the friend of mine looked at this and said this was Sarah Palin's dream house. but the point is that there's no cows, there's no horses, no goats, and so there's no what they call zoonotic diseases. Now, what this means is that this is the diseases that were over here that came this way, and this were the diseases that were over here and came this way. And this one's actually questionable, and you can see there's this enormous epidemiological imbalance. And what I'm going to suggest to you is that this is one of the central facts of history for the last 500 years, this incredible imbalance over here. Because what happened in between 1500 and 1650 is all of these guys came over here. And you can think of what happened in the Americas as all the thousands and millions of people that died in Europe and Asia over the past millennia from these diseases, all that enormous toll mortality was compressed into about 150 years over here. And there was a demographic catastrophe. It was the worst population loss in the history of the planet by this enormous shot. You know, as much as 20% of the people on Earth may have died. It was just a horrendous tragedy. And it happened largely out of sight of the Europeans. And of course, since neither side had a germ theory of disease, neither side understood what was happening. And this happened and had this enormous impact on subsequent history, both the human history and the environmental history, insofar as you can distinguish them. Now, there's a project I'm working on now with some archaeologists. We're trying to build up picture, sort of a crude idea. This is the area; these dark areas are where human beings have cleared the land, and they, you know, got corn fields, or they got fallow fields, or they burned it up so much that it's just, you know, totally not, you know, run by human beings. And then in between areas, actually, it's managed by people, it's by burning, but it's maybe every few years or so. But here are the areas that are just totally dominated by the human presence in 1500. Now, this is the same picture for 1650. Europeans are in red now. That's where Europeans are. And here's where native peoples are. And the point is, the areas dominated by the human presence have shrunk dramatically. And all this area is being filled in with forest. And so these huge forests that, you know, Thoreau writes about, that you hear about from the Sierra Club, are actually a European creation, an inadvertent European creation, is caused by the horrific collapse of these Native American cultures. So that the wilderness that you saw it was a totally recent artifact, and it was created. So when my ancestors came over in the 1670s and they looked around, they saw all these trees. Those were new trees, but of course they're coming from England where there's hardly any trees, and so they just thought, oh, this is a trackless ancient forest, which it wasn't at all. Now, this kind of impact on the landscape is true wherever you go in America, even in places that we still today think of as wilderness. And an example I would give is the Amazon. This is a sort of a typical image of the Amazon forest. I actually got it from a Greenpeace calendar. I hope you enjoy it. The Greenpeace people soaked me for the rights to use this picture. It's the most expensive picture I've ever had anything to do with. So I hope you're really just relishing its photographic beauties. And what you learn if you take what I learned when I took Ecology 101 about the tropical forest is often summarized here. And this is in eastern Bolivia. It's a cocaine processing laboratory. About 8 years before I took this picture, the U.S. government gave the Bolivian government money, and they chased the federales came in and chased the bad guys away, and created this inadvertent natural experiment. Now, here, if you did this and cleared the ground and then let it sit there for 8 years, what would happen is it's a process of ecological succession. Grasses would come in, bushes would come in, saplings would grow up, and the place would fill in from the edges, and it would be pretty soon be indistinguishable from the rest of the forest. But here you can see in the Amazon there's just this reddish soil. There's nothing that's grown here after 8 years, and the reason is that to put it in scientific terms, the rain pounds down and washes away the nutrients, and the sun bakes the rest into something resembling brick, and as a result, nothing can grow here. And the lesson that's been drawn and is in countless ecology textbooks for the last 50 years is that you can't, whether they say clear the canopy, you can't cut down the trees, because if you do that, it exposes the soil and to these terrific natural pressures, and it destroys the soil and ruins the land. And because you can't cut down the forest, you can't have agriculture. And because you can't have agriculture, you can't have complex societies, you can't have development, you can't you can't mess with the rainforest. It's got to be left alone and untouched. Other things you learn about the Amazon forest are that it's filled with all these fantastic fruits and nuts and useful species. It's a particular favorite of mine. It's the ice cream bean. It's this long bean, maybe this long, hangs down from these trees. You break it open, and there's these seeds that are here that are covered with this goo. It's like kind of like wet cotton candy. It tastes bizarrely like vanilla ice cream, sort of actually unnervingly like vanilla ice cream. And this is actually my son who had gone with me, and this was his second or third ice cream bean of the day, and he had overcome his aversion, apparently. Now, the people in the Amazon are portrayed in this way. These are the Yanomami, who have somehow become the sort of the poster children for the South American tropical forest, even though they, in fact, mostly live on this other river, the Orinoco. But they're always shown as these sort of naked people gliding through the forest. The classic book on the Yanomami is by this guy, Napoleon Chagnon. I have the deluxe edition with lots of great pictures and showing these naked people gliding through the forest, touching nothing and leaving nothing. And there's this introduction by this very famous biologist, Edward O. Wilson at Harvard, and he talks about how these people are we can see the Pleistocene when we live them. They've lived in this timeless balance of nature. Nothing has happened to them. They have done nothing. They've achieved this sort of Satori. They achieve this wonderful, balance by, and that's how they can live in the forest. Now, it's not so much that everything I've told you now is wrong, although it kind of is, but maybe a better way to say it would be that over the last 20 or 30 years, archaeologists, geographers, ecologists, botanists, scientists of many different groups have gone to the Amazon and realized the picture is actually much more complicated and, I would argue, much more interesting. But before I explain what they now think, I'd like to very briefly, I went to this high school, as I said, that not only did they tell us the wrong thing in ninth grade, but they didn't give us any geography. So I had to wait till I was in my 20s to find out where everything is. And in case any of you went to my high school, I thought I would give you a quick brush of what the Amazon's like. Here it is in South America. And the basic deal is that there's these huge mountains here. world's second largest range, you know, snow caps, the whole bit, and just a fantastic amount of water comes off of them down here and whooshes down here. It's the fifth of the world's above ground fresh water. It's just enormous amount of water. And the vertical drop, it's incredibly flat. The vertical drop between here, Quitos, and the mouths of the Amazon is less than 500 feet. I mean, it makes Massachusetts look like the Alps. It's just this huge mud basin, typically 30 to 100 feet deep. There's no stone, there's no metal. There's nothing that you would ordinarily think of that you would need to, you know, build a complex society. It's just mud. Mud is as far as you can imagine. Now, where I went at first, actually, when people were telling me to do it, was right here in eastern Bolivia. And this is, you know, what they showed me. I realized when I was looking through this to show you some pictures, I don't have any pictures of their faces because I was always last, you know, going like this. But you'll have to trust me that these are two actual archaeologists, even though I don't have their faces. And, you know, I'm not a botanist. To me, it looked like my mother's window box had just sort of blown up and, you know, everything was 100 feet tall, or else I had shrunk. But what they actually wanted to show me was this. This picture is taken maybe 200 yards from the previous picture, and the point that they were trying to make is that about a fifth of the Amazon is grassland. It's not forest at all, and it hasn't been. And then we got up on a plane where you can see things, and where we were is actually right there. The previous picture is taken right there. And do you see these? Do you see this mound here? This one here, this one here, this one here, this one here? What happened was that the original people in this area faced a problem. This is all very flat. They're right close to the Andes. And this tremendous volume of water washes down, and it overflows the banks of all these rivers. And so 4 or 5 months of the year, this area is covered with a slowly moving sheet of water that's 1 to 3 feet deep. And it's obviously a drag, you know, living in 3 foot water, 3 feet of water. So what they did is they built these mounds. There's about 10,000 of them here. And then because it's not much fun walking through knee-deep water to get to your from village A to village B, you see these straight lines here? They built these highways there so that you could get from them to the other. And if you fly over the place, you can still see traces of these things. They haven't been maintained for 500 years, so they're not in as good shape as they used to be. But they're, you know, still very, very clearly evident. One of the interesting things is that they also, the water, in addition to being a pain, was useful if you wanted to transport stuff, because you could put it in a boat and float it, and it was easier than carrying it. And so they dug these grooves in here, and that water would drain into them, and you'd get an extra 6 weeks to 2 months of relatively easy transportation out of this. And there's also on these mounds. This is Sergio, is a Bolivian archaeologist who's been very kind to me, and Clark Erickson, a Pennsylvania archaeologist, also been kind to me. And they took me out here, and they found on the mounds these things here, which are extremely difficult to see. There are these trenches that have been cut in there. It's very hard to get an idea of what they look like. Fortunately, there's been some illegal ranching, fortunately for scientists, not fortunate for the environment. And so you can see these things have been cut in there. And they're all over the place. This is a bit north in Acre in Brazil. These are also, there's about 300 of these that are now known. They're scattered over an area of about 1,000 miles. There'd be probably a lot more. It's just that you have to, you know, cut the forest down to see them. Nobody knows what they're for or really anything about them. The first published, you know, sort of serious published paper about them appeared last fall. So if any of you are looking for a career choice, this is an enormous archaeological opportunity. It'd be really interesting to find out what the heck was going on here. It's a good thing that guy Eric von Däniken never found out about these, because otherwise these would be further proof that Venusians had landed here first or something. Anyway, in addition to that are these things here. These are raised fields. They're like the raised beds in your garden, exactly the same reason you raise beds in your garden so that you improve the drainage of the soil, you get better solar exposure, you can make the soil a little bit richer. And these things are, again, all over. There's about 4,000 square miles of them. The reason for showing you all this is to try to convince you that all this wasn't built by a couple guys in loincloths. That, you know, when you have something like this, you typically, you know, while people are digging these things, you have to have somebody growing food to feed the people who are making them. You know, if you're making straight lines, you typically have to have some kind of engineer or architect or supervisors. There's a whole sort of superstructure that's involved with doing all this, and, you know, it tells you that there's lots and lots of people here. Now, the way this is all maintained, I should say, is by fire. And it still is. This is a fire of the Cyrano who live there now. If you get there in the dry season, these guys walk around with these huge boxes of safety matches. And they just leave these trails of fire behind them, the world's biggest fire bugs. It was sort of nerve-wracking. I stayed with them for a few days. Very, very nice people, addicted to practical jokes, at least the people I was with. Really, like, you know, constantly short-sheeting the bed. Anyway, you go to sleep, and you see on the horizon this line of flame like this, right? And for some reason, this made me nervous, and I kept saying, "Are you sure this is like a good idea to be sleeping totally surrounded by flame?" And they basically laughed at me, and they said, "We know what we're doing." And the answer is yes, they do know what they're doing. They've been doing this for hundreds and hundreds of years. They invited me to burn down a few acres. You can see the headline, journalist, burns down rainforest. It's not going to go. So, but the point is that there's this large-scale society here that's had this enormous impact on the environment that's essentially, because people have died, the trees are coming in and covering it over. But again, this is a new development. It's not a timeless old one. Now, I hope some of you are saying to yourselves, well, wait a minute. If there's all these people here, how did they grow anything? Didn't he show us this cocaine processing laboratory where you can't grow anything? How do they have the food to do all this? You know, why? And some of the answer is shown here. This is a papaya plantation. It's about 1,000 miles upriver, a couple of hours away from the city of Manaus. It's a perfectly plausible papaya plantation run by these Japanese family called Atahara. There's a lot of Japanese little villages up and down the Amazon. They got kicked out of, they were brought in to build railroads and so forth, and they got kicked out of the south and shoved up north. They've been going here for about 80 years. And if you look at it, it's got pretty much exactly what you'd expect would be terrible, because it's quite open. It rains a lot there. There's a lot of sun there. Yet the soil is this rich, this is the soil underneath, is this rich black stuff. It's really great stuff. You'd be happy to have it in your garden. Now, clues to what's going on are these things here. These are not stones. These are broken pieces of 900-year-old pottery. And then here's an archaeological trench for these Brazilian graduate students digging away. That's about 15 feet from the last picture. And all of this stuff is ceramics here. And you can see this very, very dark, rich soil goes down 6-7 feet. And what it is it's called black Indian earth, terra preta, and it's an artificial soil. It covers, nobody really knows, you know, how much of the river basin it covers. There's quite a bit of it. And it's made in a complicated set. There's a sort of a Brazilian-American, Austrian-Japanese group of scientists who are trying to understand it, but the main ingredient is charcoal. In other words, when they cut down the trees, instead of just burning them, they burn them at a low temperature with old charcoal, which retains 85% of the carbon, smashed it up and put it into the soil. What the charcoal appears to do is create a kind of artificial soil within the soil where all the microorganisms that make soil rich, you know, the bacteria and fungi and viruses and so forth that are important for the soil ecosystem, where they can hang out. And the result is that this place is sort of off, you know, when they do these tests of the richness of the soil, the biotic richness, as they call it, it's sort of off the charts. It's incredibly rich soil there in the tropical forest, despite the fact that it's been around for 900 years, full of charcoal, so you can do carbon dating, and it suddenly came into existence, all this, in about 900 years ago. Now, the way they farmed it was also quite different. They didn't cut down the trees and then replace them with, you know, annual crops like the way we do with, you know, wheat or rice or what have you. What they did is they call manage the succession. And so remember the ice cream bean and all those trees that I was mentioning? What those were planted. In other words, they would create an artificial forest on top of this artificial soil that would have all these useful species. And the reason that the ice cream bean and the peach peach palm and all these other useful species are found throughout the Amazon is that people planted them. So as you're going up and down the main river, and you're seeing these bluffs on either side, what you're looking at is an enormous collection of ancient orchards. It's one of the largest human artificial environments anywhere on the planet. The ceramics, I should say, we don't know anything really about. It's quite puzzling. These are some of the ones from the hole. I just pulled them out and put them on a banana leaf to take a picture of. And there's not, as you can see, they're not just sort of sheets of clay. They're actually made, and nobody really knows why. This one area, Hatahara, one of the archaeologists has estimated there are 40 million pots that were smashed in here. As you can see, these are areas where they know that where the Terra Preta is. It's nothing like a systematic survey. Basically, nobody's looked down here. The oldest Terra Preta, there's a bunch of it known down here. They think the technology went this way, starting at about 2500, sort of down here, 2500 BC, and by 1000 AD gets over here. Now, the point here is not that native peoples were these ecological saints who could do no wrong, because they certainly made mistakes. And as a bit of a counterpoint, I thought I would tell you a little bit about Cahokia, which is right here. It's right by St. Louis. About 1000 AD, a sort of a religious figure, Billy Graham type charismatic figure, sprang up. Everybody was so happy to be around him. They threw up these monuments very, very suddenly. And it was like a show capital, like the Vatican or Disneyland, a place that didn't have so much of a population as a staff, and people would, as a pilgrimage point. The problem with these places is that Billy Graham dies, the next person comes in, it becomes institutionalized, becomes less thrilling, so they have to keep the show going. So what you have here is here's Cahokia, here's St. Louis, here's the Mississippi River. Now, Cahokia, like any place, needed any human society needs energy, and in 1000 AD, this means wood. So you cut down wood here, and then they floated it down Cahokia Creek like this. Now, their version of the Army Corps of Engineers decided it had a better idea, and it cut this artificial channel like here to bring the wood to their front door. Now, this is the first large-scale city Native people have built north of the Rio Grande, so they made some beginner's mistakes. And one of them is that they didn't realize that the trees up here had this important secondary ecological function, which is retaining rainwater. In the Midwest, there's a lot of heavy rains and can flood, and so you want the trees in there to keep the water back. The second thing is if you're going to make your home more flood-prone, the last thing you want to do is construct a channel to take those floods right to your front door. And so about 1250, there's these subtle signs in the archaeological record that things are going awry. Suddenly there's like 2 feet of mud and flattened houses and so forth underneath it. Now their government depended for its popular support on the belief that it was going to protect people from natural disasters and respond quickly if one came. When that didn't happen, the poll numbers declined, and as governments will, they went into a flurry of cosmetic action to convince the populace they were doing something. And so they reconfigured all the mounds, they changed the way the ceremonies were going, they gave everybody a special badge. I'm not kidding about the badge, actually. There's this quite beautiful pendant is a better word, that only the very wealthiest burials show. And then after the flood, suddenly everybody who's buried gets to have one. But so the attempt to essentially reform it to show how much things are changed now, we're now in charge of things, but there's always people who like the old way of doing things, people like the new way of doing things. In a religious matter, it's easy to get into civil war. There's a tremendous amount of conflict. There's lots of people who are buried with their heads bashed in, burned houses, and so forth. And the result is that by 1400, the whole place is empty. This is an important story for those of you of European descent in the room. This is one of the relatively few bad things I'm going to tell you happened to Native Americans that your ancestors had nothing to do with. Now, these are true even here. As you can see, this I hope you're familiar with enough to know where we are. We're right here in Amherst. This is the Connecticut River Valley. Now, the people who lived here were the Potomtuk. About 1000 AD, Indian plant breeders figured out how to make maize, a warm weather plant, grow even up here where it's cold, but it's rather difficult. Maize requires night temperatures greater than 40 degrees Fahrenheit, requires full sun up to 10 hours a day, and requires very good soil or constant fertilization. Now, this is a problem because we're in New England, right, and warm weather is in short supply. We're in a forest, and big trees seed up, and then they don't have the main source of fertilization, which is cows and horses. So their yields are going to be pretty low, And to make them at all, they're going to have to overplant, overclear, and constantly shift to new land if they're going to get some maize going. So this area's original hub was a relatively small group of people called Pecumtuk. According to the history of Deerfield, which is as good a calculation I've seen, there's about 5,000 of them. Neil Salisbury's Manitou in Providence, an excellent book if any of you are curious about the original inhabitants of this area, really a good book. Manitou in Providence says it's about typically 7.5 people per family, this sort of back of the envelope calculation, 700 households. Martin Pring, who's a pretty good observer, came here in 1603, came out with this. And if you do this sort of crude back of the envelope calculation, you say over the 500 years they're growing maize, this small group of people is going to clear 110 square miles. Now, that's actually, if anything, an underestimate, because it hasn't included the fact that to get full sun and tall trees, at the level of Boston, if you want sun at 8 o'clock in the morning, which you really need if you're going to grow corn, you have to clear 120 feet off to the side just to get, so typical 75-foot trees don't get in your way. And the result is that this entire area, had been thoroughly cleared by the time the Europeans came here. And in fact, there is an archaeologist at Smith College who used to drive around in the 20s to the suburbs of this area. Northampton and Amherst and Hadley were just sort of growing then. And he'd go to the farmers at the edge where they're about to build houses, and he would take pictures. And what these are Indian mounds. This is the way that people grew maize back in those days. They heaped up these mounds. You planted some maize there. Then you planted beans. The beans grew up around the maize, as using it as ladders. And then you put squash and other crops down at the bottom. These are very distinctive pattern. Smith College archives are full of dozens of these guys, pictures of them all over New England. And if you do this, you see that this one group, one out of the dozens in New England, it probably cleared something like this. And this is a sort of a very crude map I've made, putting together historical accounts and Wilder's pictures and guess and spit and other things. But it gives you some idea of the large areas that were that were cleared. And then also, if you'll notice, the reason that most of these places are here is that all the earliest towns were in New England were settled on top of Indian villages, because the Indians had died from disease or been driven away by force of arms, and they would just take over these areas, and they didn't have to cut down the trees. So the patterns of New England settlement are to a large extent dictated by the patterns of native settlement before them. It wasn't that they were coming in right from scratch from the start. They were just building on top of what was already there. Sometimes it works in the other way. This is the Valley de Mezquital, which is north of Mexico City. It looks like a Sergio Leone Western. It looks like this sort of timeless Western landscape, which we've all seen before. In fact, and here it is, here's again, for those of you who didn't take geography, Mexico has these two big mountain ranges here, and then there's this high plains here in between. This is where Mexico City is, and this is where the valley we're talking about is. Now, native peoples had completely, figured out how to farm this and done this dramatic sorts of transformation. And where the valley was a series. There is all this terracing there to trap rainfall, and then there is forests. And you can still see some of them. There's a national park there, Mexico's first national park, so just off to the side. And this is what the landscape looked like. In native times, by channeling the water around and so forth, they had sort of husbanded the water, kept it in the place, and created something that was really quite lush. Now, what happened is the native people died, and the Spaniards replaced them with sheep, and you have this classic ecological phenomenon called eruptive oscillation that occurred. This is all from a terrific book by Melville called The Plague of Sheep. About 1530, they introduced 1,000 of them, 1,000 of the sheep, and there's no predators there. There's nothing to stop them, and they grow like crazy. In 25 years, there's 400,000 of them. And people start to panic because the sheep are all over the place. They start actually trying to eject them from the valley. It doesn't work. By 1565, there's 2 million of them. The Indians who are supposed to tend them and to keep them down have all died in this big epidemic. There's absolutely no control by this point of the sheep. And then by 1600, there's 200,000. There's a huge collapse in the numbers of sheep. But during this time, the sheep have just eaten everything. And the result is they've created, for the next century, there's about 250,000 sheep in this drastically reduced landscape. And the result is that this landscape here is, you know, is completely a creation of Europeans. But the odd thing is that this is what the landscape more or less looks like in areas that Indians didn't alter. So that you have, you know, so you have this question, is this a natural or an unnatural landscape? You know, it's got this enormous history behind it. It sort of looks ecologically like the landscapes that weren't touched very much. But as you can see, it's the result of this entire historic cycle. I'll leave this to you guys to figure out. It certainly caused a certain amount of head scratching when the Mexican government is trying to figure out what should the environmental plan be for this place. Should they try to restore it to the artificial landscape it was before, or should they try to keep the artificial landscape they've got now? Some other places where there's, you know, these places where native people have had this enormous impact, enduring impact, are all over the place. This is one of my favorites. This is the Colca Valley in central Peru. It's very much like the Grand Canyon. I should say that it's deeper than our Grand Canyon. One time I was telling somebody this, and they accused me of being unpatriotic because I hadn't mentioned that it's not as long as our Grand Canyon. So I'd like to reassure you that I know it's inferior. But it's, you know, kind of it's a high montane canyon, lots of little rivers splashing down here. Big difference between their inferior Grand Canyon and our superior Grand Canyon is that a society called Wari terraced the whole darn thing in about 600 AD and created this kind of thriving agricultural landscape, and all these rivers sort of splash around here and end up in there. And it's really, you know, quite remarkable. It's been fun over the years to show these pictures to civil engineers and ask them if they think that we could do this, you know, create a landscape like this that would last for 1,400 years. And I've never received what you might call an unambiguously positive response. I should say, you know, that this picture is in, I'm a journalist, I'm supposed to try to tell you the truth. This picture is in a weird way kind of a lie. When I took the picture, I was just being a tourist. I had no idea that I was going to show it to anybody except for friends and family. And I was showing it to my friend who's a professional photographer. And he said, you can't show them this picture because right there was standing this person, this huge sort of pink muumuu thing. And they said, all they'll remember is the pink muumuu. And so he took it and with Photoshop made the person go away. And so this part of the picture is like this complete lie. But this part is all true, and the part you're supposed to look at. And to just show you that this is actually a completely unretouched on anything part of the Colca Valley, you notice it's not as green. That's because it's unoccupied. There are many, many more people living in highland Peru in the 16th century than there are now, and so there's all this highly desirable real estate there that's just, you know, great farmland that's just sitting there. This isn't just a matter of South America. In the early 1980s, I took a cruise on my uncle's little boat. He lives down there, and we went up the west side of Florida, and he was telling me about all these wonderful natural mounds that are along there where the rich people live, as he put it, the millionaires live, and that's because they're the best land there. They're, you know, right close to the water, but they're above it, so that when the storms come, you know, they can ride out the storms. So finally, some archaeologists have been getting their hands on some of these, and it turns out that maybe they're not so natural after all, that they are the Calusa had these, constructed these out of this kind of cement made by smashing together millions and millions of seashells, and that these kind of line the whole west coast of Florida. There's little gaps that are halfway up between Tampa and the panhandle. It's kind of like Los Angeles, you know, one village packed right next to a really big center. And it wasn't just that they had the scrim of stuff along the coast. They had these long canals that went inside. They were used again for water management, for fishing, for transportation. And these sort of fingered in all the way up the coast of Florida. So when you go there now and people bemoan the sort of artificial landscape of strip malls and miniature golf courses, the reason to bemoan is because you don't like them. It's not because that they replaced something that was natural. You know, it had been thoroughly affected by the human presence. Again, Taos, now you're looking at this. This is the last occupied Pueblo. I hope you're looking at this and thinking, aha, specialized crafts. People had to make this. Somebody had to feed them. Somebody had to grow the crops to make this possible. This is the desert. And it turns out that there are these huge irrigation projects all the way through the Southwest. Bill Doolittle down in Texas is sort of patiently assembling the evidence for them. These are the areas that are irrigated, much larger than are irrigated to the present day. And so one of the things I tried to do at the end of my book was to sum it up in a map, and then these two cartographers, one of them, Bill Doolittle, were horrified at how bad my map was. And so we're working on this map. This is our first stab at it. I'm going back in May to work on it again. And the idea is to show these areas that are humanized, as they put it. Now, if you're looking for wilderness, there actually is some right up here. It's basically too cold to grow much here. And this is really, really dry, so there's not much happening here. This is probably not wilderness, but there's so little archaeological work done that we're trying to be conservative, and we're calling it wilderness. And then down here is the same thing. It's probably not wilderness, there's very little archaeological work done, so we're going to call it that. But pretty much everywhere else, whoops, I didn't know this could do this. Okay, here we are. It's thoroughly marked by the human human presence, and that there are these thriving, active societies here that we're still living in the world that they helped create. Obviously, Europeans have had a tremendous, and their descendants have had a tremendous impact as well. But it's not like it was a blank template beforehand. And if you have the right eyes to see what's there, you can still see a lot of how the landscape looked. And that's what I came here to tell you about. Thank you. The epidemiological separation is because you didn't have people in close contact. All those diseases emerged since the first domestication, which is about 11,000 years ago.
Okay.
So you just need a few thousand years. And we've seen that with the bird flu, right?
Yeah.
You have all these people in southern China. I don't know if any of you guys have been there, but the people in southern China are just, you're surrounded by poultry when you're down there. And it's sort of made to order for the evolution of these kinds of diseases. And they just simply didn't have that time. And so the extra time doesn't make any difference. You only need a few thousand years.
Okay.
Two questions. One, how and when was the Amazon named the Amazon? Where it comes from and when? And second question, it's fascinating to see how much people were living in the Amazon. What do we know about the political systems
Well, the name comes from Oriana, who is the first European to go down there. There's this amazing account. He was one of the conquistadors, and they were going after El Dorado. Do you guys know what El Dorado is? The city of gold. This completely misguided expedition where they had sort of vaguely heard that there was a city of gold, and basically you can tell one group of natives is saying, it's over there, get out of here. And it's led by one of the Pizarros, who are the brothers, these four brothers who sort of wiped out Peru. And they end up, it's this incredibly, one of the curious things if you read the Amazon is this incredibly rich environment. There's just fabulously rich. But because Europeans don't know what's good there, right? They don't know what to eat. They're constantly starving to death in the midst of plenty. And so these guys are just starving in this areas where it's absolutely fantastically rich. So they with a sort of last energy they build this boat and they send Oriana, this guy, down there to find food. And he goes about 400 or 500 miles down the Napo and he finds this tributary and he finds this food and he finds a big village and they basically rob them at gunpoint and get the food. And then they think, well, maybe we won't go back upstream 400 miles. Mm-hmm. We'll just float downstream because how long can this river be? And it takes them 5 months to get down there. And it's an amazing record. There's a priest there, Carvajal, who records it. And they, at one point, he very soberly thinks that they're being fired on by these female warriors, literally the Amazons, and hence they call it the river of the Amazons. And actually, it sounds completely crazy, but the anthropologists I've talked to feel a lot of sympathy because they always say, it's really hard to tell what's going on, and there's these people. people on the, you know, who are telling them, oh yeah, there's women here, you know, who are warriors and so forth. You know, your informants are very willing to pull your leg. And so, anyway, that's the reason. They literally thought that there were Amazons there. And the political structure is there. Basically, they don't really know. Because this environment is so wealthy, though, and again, this is a brand, there's hardly any work done on this. It's another big area if anybody wants to do a PhD. There's like two or three books on, you know, this entire area. But it's such a rich environment, it's very difficult for people to be coercive, you know, because you can always just go up a river and make it. It's kind of like, you know, how Huck Finn can just make his living on the river. You can always do that. And so that these societies had to be much more cooperative and sort of hang loose type places. And the result is that they're fairly large but didn't have much state apparatus. And they had these extensive cities. There's a first article about them appeared in Science last September, I think. And they have these sort of, they're very much like the City Beautiful movement in the early 19th century. They have these sort of wheel-shaped cities that are packed into the landscape down there, one after the other. They're very, very extensive, and probably, you know, thousands of people in one sort of one wheel-like thing next to thousands of people next, without a clear sort of hierarchical structure. I don't know if that answers your question, because the real answer is we don't know that much. The two guys, Pachacuti and Tupac Inca, were kind of like guys who sort of built that empire. Were kind of like Alexander the Great. You know, it's a kind of similar phenomenon. You sort of say, oh, why did how was Alexander the Great, you know, able to do this? Because it wasn't like you see immediate advantages. And I think that the archaeologists say you just can't underestimate the willingness to make completely unprovoked, brutal attacks. You know, for no reason on your neighbors. You'll often win when you do this. Then you start getting this sort of steamroller effect because you can conscript people, and you start to get, you know, larger and larger larger and larger groups. Now, typically these things are kind of short lived, so we'll never know what would have happened to the Inca. So that would be, it's not a really satisfactory answer, but that's what they tell me. The typical numbers are 40 to 60 million, but those numbers keep going up. And as I mentioned, my personal guess would be 80 to 100 million by the time the dust shifts, but that's just a guess. It's very hard to know how much, because essentially these, you know, somebody would come on the coast with a disease, and you have people who just didn't have any contagious diseases. There's a Kiowa memoir woman who writes about how they had no idea that you could give a disease to another person. They thought it would be like giving your wound to another person. You know, it was just nothing they'd ever seen. And so consequently, all these things of isolation and quarantine that Europeans knew about were completely foreign to their culture. So what would happen when somebody got sick is the whole family and their friends would gather around them, right? And then they would all get the disease. People would panic. And as you can imagine, it's a totally foreign phenomenon, and they would flee because they would think something must be wrong here, you know, here, right? And they would take the disease with them, and these diseases and infect the next town, and these diseases would explode like a chain of firecrackers, you know, far into the countryside, away from the Europeans. So most of the people who died, you know, had never seen a European. So estimates, you know, sort of range from 75% it sort of doesn't matter. I mean, it's just that's a huge, huge toll. It's unlike anything any society can survive. It's sort of remarkable that Native societies survived at all.
And did the survivors have this?
No, it doesn't really sort of work that way, because it wasn't they were the ones who survived were just lucky. You know, the diseases come in different strains. Some of them are a little less virulent than others. You get, some people just were away and didn't get sick. You know, it's evolution doesn't happen that quickly. And in fact, it's one of the problems in the Amazon now is that, there's these peoples who are very little contacted, and they have to be kept in a kind of an epidemiological bubble because, they're so vulnerable still to native diseases, non-native diseases.
I'm wondering if our desire to perceive the pre-colonial landscape as an untouched wilderness is somehow connected to our desire to see indigenous communities as communities that don't have agency necessarily. So I guess I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the connection between how we want to perceive indigenous communities versus how we perceive the environment.
I think it's a really complicated question, and I don't know if there's like a answer that you can hold up and touch and say this is the answer, but my guess is that some of it would have to do with lots of Christian stuff about gardens and wildernesses and places where original sin is not touched, and that fits also in with one of the things is that the Europeans are trying to figure out how to justify what they're doing, and there's a legal doctrine called res nullius, which is something like that in Latin, R-E-S-N-U-L-L-I-U-S. What that is that if land is not being used, then you can just move in. And so it was very important, to say, look, this land is not being used, and so we can have it. And then you add the fact that a lot of landscape that the first Europeans saw was empty, but it was not empty so much as emptied. You swirl all those sort of things together, and you end up with this very powerful idea that that this landscape was a sort of holy and untouched place, and that that we're busy defiling. And I think you still see that today in the environmental movement. There's a real resistance in some parts of it to sort of saying that this land was handled by and marked by non-native people.
So if Amazonian people really suppressed forests through fire regimes and so on, they'll also have a major impact on biodiversity. There's such a high degree of endemism in the Amazon. Every time you burn an acre, you're simultaneously causing extinction. So has there anything written about
There's some stuff by Christine Paddock, and there's a bunch of people written about it. Well, it's very interesting, and basically what people do is they create edges. We're making the landscape more landscape more patchy by we're cutting down this part for fuel, and we're growing stuff here, and within certain limits that actually increases biodiversity. And in fact, the areas like in the Peruvian Amazon that Christine Paddock studies, where native people have lived in their population centers there's a pretty close correspondence between hotspots of biodiversity and those areas. And they also, improvements in soil quality, make the whole, there's much more for everybody to all these different species to share. And so these areas with the Terra Preta, in the lower and central Amazon and the southern Amazon are fantastically wealthy biologically as well. So there's a real win-win relationship there, which is kind of hopeful, actually, I think, that people don't always have to trash the place.
Why
do I not actually think that?
Yeah, so what evidence?
Oh, well, there's a there's some. Well, the Pacific Northwest has not really been studied in this way. That was the first place I pointed to. There's a guy named Doerr, D-O-E-R-R, who's just published a book that's collecting, it came out maybe 2 years ago, that's collecting the evidence people have studied. And they all say, no, this place is thoroughly farmed. But, you know, it's just a small amount of work that's been done. At the mouth of the Columbia River, there are these huge farms of this sort of seaweedy stuff that they changed the shape of the mouth and they planted it, and then there's lots of evidence that they're burning to for all these berries they have in the Northwest. But again, it's been such a powerful image. I grew up in the Northwest, and you know, we were always taught, you know, tall trees, silent, and so forth. So that it's been quite difficult in a sense for people there to wrap their heads around that maybe it wasn't always like this. So that's why I said that. And I'm working with these two guys, and they said, we can't just do all this on one book. You got to be more skeptical than that, is what they're saying. But I live there. I tend to think that they're being too skeptical. But two against one. That's a really good question. It's a really long question. It's not really a 30-second answer. So what I'm going to do is, maybe at the end of this, if anybody wants to hear it, I'll tell you about it. I just can't think of a 30-second response. So, but I'm not. I'm sort of ducking the question, but to answer it later, because otherwise I'll talk for 10 minutes.
How do you think that this different conception of what the ecological sort of baseline in North and South America is? How do you think that can inform? Like, let's say you're put in a position where you get to decide, policies to deal with tropical reforestation or something like that, which is rapidly occurring through Central America as places as people are moving out of the rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
What is your advice to someone who's making the policy today about this?
I think that it's really. I'm a little hesitant because this is going from the, and what I've been telling you is what I think actually happened, and it's sort of in the realm of fact, and now you're going into the realm of opinion. I don't necessarily think my opinion's worth any more than anybody else's. In general, I would say this is something that really should be engaged, like people should work on, democratically. One of the things that, this is a gross generalization, but one of the things that's striking to me when I talk to Native peoples and from what I can see there is that we have as a European culture, we're constantly looking back to a golden past, this wonderful state, this golden era that existed 500 years ago or, 1,000 years ago or whatever, Garden of Eden, and we wrecked it, and we should try to recapture it. And that's actually more or less what the Wilderness Act of 1963, which is the sort of foundational environmental document, says, is that, untrammeled by the hand of man and all this. And what we're trying to do is recover this original sacred state. But by and large, indigenous is much more future-oriented. It's like, what kind of landscape do we want to live in? Let's build it. My own feeling is that's that attitude would be much more productive for us to think, what can we do as a society to join together, and what kind of place do we want to live in?
How long have the alpaca and llama been domesticated, and would that be long enough for diseases to transfer?
Yeah, they've been domesticated for a few thousand years, and it would be, they're in a very cold environment where if that kind of stuff is going to, be suppressed, it's going to be more likely to be suppressed up at 12,000 feet than it is, in some place where it's 100 degrees all the time. So that would be, and the llamas are also very rarely outside of, they don't function well at lower altitudes particularly. And so there is some evidence that there were some unusual diseases that, we report in there's lots of records from these, and they're diseases that we don't really know what they are, and they may have been indigenous diseases that were in the that were in that area. But we you know, that's an excellent question. I don't think anybody really knows the answer. Again, this is my opinion, right? So, but my, it seemed to me when I grew up, you know, in the Northwest, you know, you know, I was very strongly affected by the environmental movement. It was very clear to me that what we were trying to do was recreate what, you know, the wilderness that was as close as we could to the wilderness that was there. And my whole class, you know, went into forest management. They're in the Park Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service, and you know, working for timber companies and so forth. That's where I grew up. And we basically, most of them retried to create a wilderness and create a disaster, because in fact that isn't what it was like there before. And we were creating a completely new kind of ecosystem inadvertently. And part of the reason that there's these terrible fires now in the West and so forth is because, you know, people like me and my classmates had this idea in our heads. And I suspect, you know, that's an immediately practical reason. And the other thing is that, you know, again, for me personally, this idea that we had then, that we are this sort of stain, you know, on the earth, and our goal was to, you know, clean it up as much as possible. You know, finally I thought, you know, people are okay, actually, sometimes. And, you know, people can interact with, and the story of America is replete with examples of people. It's not like the people were saints, but they were very clever about how they manipulated the landscape. And you go down to southern Mexico, and there are places that have been farmed continuously for 7,000 years, and they're still productive today. And you go to Mesopotamia, to southern Turkey and so forth, where I've seen, and those places were wrecked. You know, by people who started farming at the same time and didn't understand how to do it. And so I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned. And for these people probably had less sophisticated, you know, technology of physics, you know, or something, or metallurgy, or if you like. But they're very, very good at ecology and botany and so forth. And so I think there's we'd be foolish not to pick up on the lessons there. But that's, again, that's, you know, I'm reluctant to keep blabbing away my opinion. You know, so ask me a factual question.
I was just going to ask if, in the context of doing all this research, if you looked into it all, sort of oral histories going back to the sort of contact period, and what kind of perspective that added to the picture you're creating.
Well, this is a resource that people are just beginning to exploit. There's a terrific book called First Time by First Dash Time. I can't remember the name, it's in Suriname, and it's an amazing book. He collects oral histories of, you know, people recounting, and then he matches it to the Dutch archives of what happened. And it's an amazingly, they're you know, obviously not everything's right, but they're an amazingly good source. And so this was published 15 years ago, and so in those last 15 years, it's been a real explosion of research where people are going, folklorists, so to speak, are going back and saying, well, maybe these just aren't stories. And there's been a real reevaluation of that. It hasn't really worked its way into the textbooks yet, partly because through these other sources, you know, these people had always been saying things like, everybody died when the Europeans came, and other sources are now telling us that was right. So in some sense, some of the things that they told us or have been telling us, people have learned independently through other sources, and it's confirming it. I've actually, you know, in a modest way, sort of inquired about this. It turns out that the way that textbooks are made in this country is really bizarre. Apparently, there's these, in many of the states have these state bodies that have to approve the textbooks. And of course, if you're a textbook company, you want, you know, the big states to approve your textbook. So you want, do you want to be able to sell it in New York, Texas, and California, which are the three biggies. And apparently the New York body is, as you would expect, super liberal. And the Texas one is super conservative, and the California one is super crazy. And that's what they tell me. And so that once they've threaded the needle of, you know, getting it past all these people with these mutual, unreconcilable objections, everybody's really reluctant to change anything. There's a real institutional drag on that. And the second thing is that history textbooks are written by, as you would expect, historians. And one of the odd things about the discipline of history, it's just ridiculous when you think about it, is that they have this division of history and prehistory. And no other social, economics doesn't have, say, like, oh, we don't study that. You know, they just move right in and say whatever they want. The same thing's true for psychology, all these other things. But history, no, we don't study this. And so they get to this point, you know, where they hire the colonial historian and to write this, and he goes, oh, gosh, we got to have something about these Indians. And he sort of, you know, does this for a few pages, and then quickly goes on to, you know, George Washington and Columbus and things like that that they're comfortable with. So you have these two barriers in the way, which is that the historical profession itself and the and it's pretty potent, I think.
Can you see a way to like break down the barriers?
Well, I actually I was invited to this outfit that it's a. I mean, America's amazing. I mean, we have like associations for things you would not believe could have associations. It turns out there's a association of history book writers. and they invited me to talk. So I thought, what have I got to lose? So I tried the technique of public shaming. And I collected all the one volume histories of the Americas that I could find, also world histories. And I counted up the number of pages just, you know, devoted to the first 20,000 years of American history. And then the number of pages devoted to, like, you know, the Shays Rebellion. It was very, you know, it's pretty much what you would expect. Some trivial incidents or less important incidents in American history got more than 20,000 years of this. And so, and then the other great thing is they always had the same pictures. And the pictures were always wrong. Like the picture in they all said, oh, this is terrible. So who knows? I don't know if they all said this is terrible and went home and said, that guy's done, or what.